we're building and replacing a deteriorating facility for the current users, and there certainly are users that are being turned away.
Unalaska prepares to upgrade their port for larger vessels. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, advocates for saving domestic violence prevention programs are hopeful about state program money.
And I think people really like these programs. I think it gave people a certain amount of hope.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A proposed voter initiative to ban set nets in urban parts of Alaska is making its way toward the ballot, while a lawsuit over its legality continues. Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance President Joe Connors says his organization has been collecting signatures to ask voters on the August 2016 ballot whether to ban commercial set nets in non-subsistence areas. That would primarily affect the Upper Cook Inlet commercial set net fishery. The Alaska Supreme Court likely will make a final decision on whether the proposed ban is constitutional and can qualify for the ballot. Oral argument in the case has been requested, but likely won't occur until August or later. A decision also is pending on whether to allow a fishing and resources advocacy group to participate in arguments. Unalaska is getting ready to spend tens of millions of dollars to upgrade the aging port of Dutch Harbor. The hope is to serve bigger ships and more of them. But the companies that use the dock right now aren't so sure that big changes are needed. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
On Wednesday night, Unalaska's city council chambers were full of dock workers, fuelers, and cargo companies that have worked in Dutch Harbor for 25 years, exporting seafood and importing freight. They were there to weigh in as the city gets ready to remodel the port for the future. The $44 million plan involves replacing rotten pilings under the dock that serves container ships, barges, and catcher processors, and adding anything new that those companies want to see. That might include a setup for a bigger cargo crane, one to reach further across wider ships. The current crane is on 50-gauge rails, meaning spaced 50 feet apart. Some ports, including Anchorage, have upped that to 100 feet. Marion Davis is a vice president for Horizon Lines, the main domestic shipper in Dutch Harbor. They own the current crane, and Davis says its 50-foot spacing works just fine.
A lot of ports are huge ports, so they might have 6, 8, 10 lanes of trucks underneath the crane. Therefore, you need the room underneath the crane. Dutch will never have that. So a 50-gauge crane should be sufficient no matter what you do.
He did suggest bringing in a new 50-gauge crane built for a wider reach, but that's not part of the city's project. Any new cranes would have to come from the users, like Horizon. They were the city's official shipping partner when the dock was first built, but that contract fell apart a few years ago. In March, the city council voted not to seek a new one from Horizon or anyone else. Horizon still gets a guaranteed spot for their weekly mail and grocery delivery, according to a recent letter from the city, but otherwise the dock space is up for grabs. That means power is an open question, too. Right now, the port runs mostly on diesel, but Doug Leggett, the president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in Unalaska, asked if the city's electrical grid could handle more ships or cranes plugging in.
I spent plenty of time watching them breathing that exhaust, and I think most of us don't realize how much pollution they pump into town here when they're sitting there. The wind's blowing and you don't see it, but it's a lot.
Other dock workers brought up cosmetic issues like bad drainage, bumpy concrete, and safety issues that need repairing. And they talked about the best spot for a new warehouse that barges and seafood companies could share. All that helps the companies at the dock right now, but much of the plan still centers on the idea that more bigger traffic is on the way. Longshoremen like Jeff Hancock were skeptical.
I mean, you've got a picture or an outline of a gigantic, large 1,200-foot vessel there at the dock. In what realistic thinking would we ever have a vessel of that size here that we needed to work the number of containers that would be? In what reality would we ever need that much capacity at this port?
no ice in the Arctic.
That's Dennis Robinson, a longshoreman and former city councillor. He's talking about the biggest unknown in upgrading Dutch Harbor. Will melting Arctic ice and more Arctic infrastructure really create that much demand from new shipping companies? If it will, they didn't show up on Wednesday to say so. But City Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin says she heard enough to move the designs forward and to keep working on a funding plan. She needs to break ground by 2017 for permitting reasons.
We're building and replacing a deteriorating facility for the current users, and there certainly are users that are being turned away because of timing issues and dock schedules that will be able to utilize this proposed design.
For now, the port's oldest tenants will drive that design, and McLaughlin hopes it'll leave room for those waiting in the wings. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The public can comment on the port redesign until May 29th. Earlier in the legislative session, a Senate subcommittee slashed all of the state funding for domestic violence and sexual assault prevention programs. It would have impacted projects like Girls on the Run and Choose Respect. Now, with the governor's revised budget, some of that money has been put back. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Alaska tops a lot of lists. Best whale watching, cleanest air quality,
child sexual abuse, infant rape, domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking.
Peggy Brown is the executive director at the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She says when the network heard their 2016 state budget for prevention programs was being eliminated, it felt like being kicked in the rib.
Not to use violent language, but, you know, they got the breath knocked out of them a little bit.
In the 5 years the prevention programs existed in Alaska, there have already been signs of success. One program, called the 4th R, was able to identify students who experienced sexual violence and role-play healthy relationships.
And I think people really liked these programs. I think it gave people a certain amount of hope with these horrible numbers that maybe there were just kind of some normal, simple things that normal, simple folks could do rather than breaking up a fight or calling 911.
Now, some of that lost funding might be reinstated. Governor Bill Walker's revised budget allocates $1.5 million for sexual assault prevention programs, about half of last year's.
And we understand, I mean, the state's in a difficult spot right now, but that 1.5 is critical to maintain projects moving forward.
Lori Morton is the executive director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She says 10 communities in Alaska currently have readiness prevention programs that help jumpstart the bigger ones.
If we have the 1.5 million restored, the number of those communities will be reduced to 5.
Morton couldn't say which locations would be cut. Projects like Green Dot, which teaches violence intervention skills, won't be able to spread to other communities as quickly as the network hoped. But most sexual and domestic violence prevention programs will still be able to function. Peggy Brown says for prevention work to actually be effective, it has to saturate the area for at least 5 years.
And we were just at the 5-year mark, and we were just getting data to complete evaluation of a lot of these different programs.
In 2011, the Alaska Victimization Survey in Juneau showed 55 out of every 100 women suffered from domestic violence or sexual assault. The network hopes that number's decreasing. A 2016 version of the survey could confirm that, but it's contingent on the $1.5 million in the governor's revised budget. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska student wins the National Poetry Out Loud competition.
The snakeskin fraternal twins of solstice and equinox, the ashen dawn, silvering dusk.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
West Anchorage High senior Mava Ordaz won the National Poetry Out Loud competition this week in Washington, D.C. It's the first time an Alaskan has both reached the finals and won. Ordaz won $20,000 for her recitation of a poem by Brenda Cardenas.
We are between the flicker of a chameleon's tail that turns his desert blue backbone to jade or pink sand. The snakeskin fraternal twins of solstice and equinox, the ashen dawn, silvering dusk, la oración as it leaves the lips, the tug from sleep, the glide into dreams that husk out mestizo memory.
Ordaz has a full scholarship to Columbia University next year. Shannon Doubt is the executive director of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, which runs Poetry Out Loud in Alaska. The program was started 10 years ago by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation.
Poetry helps us kind of sense and think differently about the world around us. It encourages more kind of abstract and creative thought, which is really crucial for kids to develop to, you know, help them be competitive in the workforce that is increasingly relying on creative thought and problem solving.
You can watch Ordaz's winning recitation on alaskapublic.org. Homer resident Jean Aspen has re-released her book, Arctic Daughter, 3 decades after she first wrote about her adventures living off the grid in the Brooks Range. Aspen's mother was a wilderness explorer who instilled in her daughter a love of and understanding about the importance of human connection to wilderness. Aspen says she's revised the book for a new generation of young people looking to make their own connections to our wilderness roots.
Wilderness is our natural home. It is who we are. And we have had our journey hijacked by commerce. We have been seduced and conditioned away from believing in who we are. And I think in order to hear that inner voice, it requires a certain quiet that we don't actually get an opportunity to have. Going into wilderness, wild places, even the wildness of your own backyard, and spending time with the planet is a deepening of that journey.
Are there ways that you can think of for people who are in urban settings to find that peace somehow? Any thoughts about that?
Well, there's something called the homeostatic blender, which means that we become accustomed to whatever happens in our lives. We adjust to cigarette smoking, to noise, to confusion, to multitasking. Doesn't mean it's what's best for us. And you can see by the disease in the population, by the anxiety, by the depression in young people, that we're not on our own authentic soul path. And I think in order to return to that, you have to be able to break some of those habitual patterns. For me, turning off the television, we threw ours away 25 years ago. To have that continuous noise in your life is an addiction, not unlike cigarette smoking, and it's not good for us.
Did you realize that your mom was unusual among women of her generation? Some may have gone camping or backpacking, but very few spent big chunks of time in extremely remote locations. What did you think of that? How did that change or inspire you?
Actually, in my childhood, women didn't go backpacking or camping that I knew. But my mother took me out, as she had gone when she was young, into the Catalina Mountains. And I remember my first backpack with her. The first time I walked down from Mount Lemmon, I was 4 years old. And I recall that journey quite well. I always enjoyed that piece of life. My mother was a complex person, and she struggled against the very rigid ideas of what women should be in her day and age. And she was not comfortable with that, but she had very little support from any community member. She was just an oddball.
You were 22 when you and Phil Beisel decided to head into the Arctic.
Yes.
When, before that age, did you decide you were going to sort of follow in your mom's footsteps, so to speak?
And that's another interesting question, because I never thought of myself as doing that. It's only in retrospect that I realized that I became a lot like my mother. And in fact, I struggle with some of those issues. My mother was an environmentalist before there was much ideas about that. There was a belief that the world went on forever. And my mother was a founding member of Arizonans for Water Without Waste, which later became Arizonans for Wilderness, Water, and Wildlife. And they met at our house. I think for me it was mostly I wanted to get away from the expectations. I was getting ready to graduate from college. I wanted to go to medical school, and I thought, I really need some time out of this rat race. I don't know that I'm really ready for this. And I certainly wanted the experience of being back in wilderness. I'd spent quite a bit of time in wilderness already. My mother had taken my sister and I canoeing to the Arctic Ocean through Canada for two summers when I was 14 and 15, and my sister was 12 and 13. Down the Peace, Slave, and Mackenzie River systems, 3,000 miles.
Jean, how would you say that living in the wilderness has changed your worldview?
That's a hard question for me. I can't imagine life without wild lands. I don't see myself as separate from the planet. I think our human community has grown way out on an unsustainable pathway, and unless we find our way back to those roots as a part of the community of life, we won't make it.
Why is your book important for a new generation? What do you want younger people to take away from reading it?
Two things is I'd like people to fall in love with the land through my eyes, and I would also like young people to take a look at where they're investing their own lives and see if there isn't something else they'd rather be doing, because life is short.
Jean Aspin's newly revised book, Arctic Daughter, is available in stores and online. Federal wildlife managers are still trying to determine the fate of feral cattle that have long gone without caretakers on an uninhabited Alaska island. An aerial survey last fall counted more than 2,000 cattle on Chirchikov Island, nearly triple an earlier estimate of 800. The animals are descendants of cattle first brought there in the late 1880s to provide meat for whaling crews and fox traders. The Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge has long planned to remove the non-native herd, which are battering the habitat of native wildlife such as seabirds and salmon. Now refuge officials are working on a draft environmental impact statement to explore all options, including leaving the animals in place. Refuge manager Steve Delahanty says he hopes the draft is ready for public comment this year. The Alaska Public Offices Commission is looking into a complaint against an Anchorage mayoral candidate over an improper corporate donation. The complaint was filed against Ethan Berkowitz by David Neese, who has run unsuccessful campaigns for seats in the House and on the Anchorage School Board. In the document submitted to APOC, Neese says that Berkowitz used images from a KTUU newscast in a campaign ad, but failed to disclose it. Nora Morris is a spokeswoman for the campaign and says the use of media in ads is commonplace.
Political campaigns use news clips all the time. This complaint is just another distraction to the Anchorage voters. It's an unfounded claim, but hopefully it will be resolved this afternoon.
APOC is holding an expedited hearing on the issue today.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Kwong. This week on AK, a forgotten boat. A group in Kodiak recently completed an Aleutic boat. that was last seen in the mid-19th century. Aleutic people once used the Unyuk to travel over long distances and through rough seas. It's an open boat, like a dory, with a flat bottom and bulbous bow. The artist leading the effort says the boat builders aren't just recreating the past. They're reviving a piece of Aleutic history for use now and in the future. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
CJ Christensen saws the curved edge of a seat he'll install in his Unyuk. This is the first time Kodiak has seen an Unyuk in about 150 years. Christensen says the last record of it was from a stranded British sailor's first-hand account of his rescue in 1850. The boat's 21-inch frame sits on supports in the back room of a former grocery store that's now mostly used for storage. Christensen, who has carved everything from masks to harpoons, says his interest in building the Unyuk came from his desire to recover a piece of Aleutic culture. He says Unyuks were a big part of Kodiak life.
Anybody should be able to do this. It's not that hard. It just takes a lot of dedication and pride in what you're doing, you know, making sure everything fits. It's really just taking art to the next level, you know, going from one small art form to something bigger.
Christensen says kayaks were the everyman boat, but Unyuks were special to Aleutic people. The flat bottom and rounded bow would have helped it float up strong waves.
They had winter and summer habitations here. So in the summer, when they went to go put up all their fish and all their food for winter supply, they would pack up the village in one of these boats and move it down to their summer habitation and then be able to bring back all the fish they put up and everything.
Christensen says villages took the boat hundreds of miles from the mainland to southeast, all around Kodiak and the Aleutians. He says there are only a few sources that prove the Unyuk's existence, which makes building it a challenge. The group partially used the Yupik boat, the Umyak, as a guide.
Because our people are related to the Yupik. We looked at their boat designs and had a book on how they were building their boats. We kind of took their designs and modified them to what our boats looked like.
But they also used one of the last remnants of the Unyuk, wooden models Russian settlers took back home with them. The models not only provide physical representations of the boat, but also reveal who might have owned them. Christensen believes one family may have been responsible for the boat.
Let's see, there's this picture of the boat. So you got the guy up there with the drum, the guy steering, and these guys all paddling. And then you see this guy here, see his hat? Each one of these little rings is how many potlucks he gave. So, you know, three potlucks, he was a rich man. So he probably owned the boat.
Christensen says he and the other crafters put about 300 hours into the frame, but he says he was reluctant to track their progress from beginning to end. He didn't want to fail. But he says trial and error is the key to building a boat that hasn't been seen for so many years.
We might not got 100% right now, but if more people start building them and we start putting these in the water and, you know, taking them out and trying them, you know, we're going to refine the design back to, like, Russian time, pre-contact. They were probably still refining it when they had contact.
Christensen says he wants to make this a boat for Aleutic people now, not just recreate a relic from the past.
To be building one is just, I mean, it's an amazing journey for me to see this thing come to life. You know, I don't want to be the only one who makes one of these. I mean, 10 years down the road, I want to see everyone building them.
He says he hopes people will even race Unyuks. But first, they need to find a place for this one. Alicia Drabeck is the executive director at the Aleutic Museum. She says they'll exhibit the boat outside the museum in mid-May and then look for a permanent space. She says she's proud to be able to showcase the boat.
For the first one to be built in over a century, it's amazing that it came together as quickly as it did. And they're living the culture. They're not doing this as part of a museum project. They're doing it out of their hearts.
Back in the old grocery store, one of the group members is putting a finishing touch on the boat, securing part of the frame with twine. Christensen and his team are excited to see their work on display later this month, and eventually they hope to test out an Unyuk in the waves around Kodiak. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we hear from Christy Willett, who moved to Alaska from New York State as a young teacher in 1975. Her first teaching job was in Heidelberg on Prince of Wales Island. She remembers her first week in town vividly.
It was late in the day. Of course, I'd left from Syracuse, New York that morning, and it was approaching dusk. It was getting dark, and it was one of those gray, misty days where the sky and the water and the mountains are just all kind of the same color. And we walked through town, and the streets weren't paved. It was muddy, and it had been raining for a while. It was muddy, and there were puddles, and there was nobody out. And the teacher that was living in the apartment already next door had come up earlier in the summer so she could spend the summer in Heidelberg. And she had two young kids, and she was just so happy to see me. She says, "I'm so glad you're here. And isn't it just the most lovely day? This is the best day we've had all summer." And I just thought, oh my, what have I got myself into? Because it was just gray and dismal and raining. I started school with an empty room. There was not a desk or a chair or a board. There was no paper or pencils or crayons. There was nothing. And so we had school that day, and I kind of remember we sang a lot of songs. A lot of songs.
After Heidelberg, Christy Willett taught on a floating logging camp in Southeast and then finished the rest of her career in Ketchikan. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Kayla DeRoche, Ann Hillman, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven, Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast offers an online occupational endorsement in financial institutions, covering banking and accounting concepts and principles. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.